content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine, dated June 10, 2024. This Time Magazine is, as usual, embellished with bright red around the borders of the cover, with a narrow white inner border, and Time in large block lettering in pale gray, superimposed upon a darker gray background featuring a portrait of the radical Javier Milei, whose story you will not hear. I'm moving instead to The View, The Nation, Demonizing Rural America, by Bobby, B-O-B-I, Conn, C-O-N-N, who is the author of Someplace Like Home. By the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I was keenly aware of my father's drug use. He did not snort pills in front of me yet. He saved that for my teen years, but he talked about pills freely, and I knew he took them. And by the time I became an adult, everyone in my nuclear family, and plenty in my extended family, was struggling to cope with the impacts of violence, incarceration, and addiction. I grew up in Appalachian Eastern Kentucky, where systemic poverty has been a challenge for many decades. We always joked that Kentucky was 20 years behind the rest of the country, but as a kid I did not understand what we really faced. Underfunded schools, inadequate transportation systems, poor health care, unreliable utilities. Prescription pain pills flooded into our region and did nothing to cure our collective pain, but instead exacerbated the personal and social struggles that the region is often associated with. Through a wide range of experiences, I learned at a young age that we were poor white trash. The stereotypes about us were and continue to be disdainful and dismissive, mixed with a potent disgust for good measure. Americans have discarded and scapegoated various socioeconomic groups throughout our history. Unlike many biases that we have reckoned with, though, the vitriolic view of Appalachia, and to some extent other areas of rural America, stems from an entrenched classism that remains unchallenged in our collective moral consciousness. The most popular Mexican restaurant in our small town of Berea, Kentucky, has several machines where you can buy gumballs, small toys, even temporary tattoos. When they were little, my kids always begged for a quarter or two so they could buy something after we ate there. But there was one novelty that made me cringe every time, and I forbade my children from spending quarters on it. Hillbilly teeth. The teeth did not offend my sensibilities. They publicized my shame. I grew up in a holler, and that's spelled H-O-L-L-E-R. And the well my father dug for our house never functioned quite right. My parents often had to pump creek water into the well so we would have water pressure, and I knew we were not supposed to drink it, but we still mixed it with Kool-Aid and coffee, cooked with it, brushed our teeth with it. Most of the time, we drank milk or pop. Why my parents did not get us clean drinking water, and why did they not ensure we had proper dental health? The first reason for those oversights was my father's drug addiction. The second was his relentless abuse of my mother, my brother, and me. visits to the dentist fixing the well, braces for my permanent teeth, those concerns fade into the background for both the drug-addicted and traumatized minds. The hillbilly teeth at the restaurant served as a cruel reminder it is socially acceptable to mock the socioeconomic class I was born into. Our problems are a joke. Another popular, insidious sentiment loomed large in the 2016 election, and I suspect it was infused into early conversations about our opioid problem. They deserve what they get. The 2024 book, White Rural Rage, highlights the problematic conversations around Appalachia in interesting ways. Early in the book, the authors claim rural America poses a quadruple threat to democracy. And they begin their critique with Mingo County, West Virginia. The authors decry the fact that this county's majority vote went to Donald Trump in both 2016 and 2020, but fail to acknowledge an important fact in Appalachian voting, and indeed in voting among many vulnerable populations. Fewer than half the registered voters cast a ballot in either election. They're used as an easy target, a convenient stand-in for the diverse population that actually makes up rural America, because they are considered to be poor, ignorant, white trash that no one will defend. But classism is not just a problem when someone writes a book about it, and it is not just a problem when people blame election results on some of our most disenfranchised citizens. Classism tells us to blame rural whites for our country's ills, just as other populations have been blamed in the past. Demonizing our neighbors instead of the dysfunctional systems, and perhaps even individuals who hold incredible power over our political and financial well-being. Rural Americans grapple with the same issues as everyone else: poverty, violence, addiction, and social decay. Just as there is no excuse for bigotry, we cannot blame our country's challenges on a disempowered socioeconomic group. Placing blame fuels divide. Instead, we must understand our biases and find a way to move past them. There's a photo here, not quite a quarter of a page. I'll read the caption first. Mason, West Virginia, in 2017, from photographer Stacy Kranitz's work documenting Appalachia. This does not look like a mountain town. The main street that we see is level, but it's hard for me to determine whether it's asphalt or gravel. There is a stop sign at an intersection where 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kids are riding around on bicycles, apparently in a circle. It's a mild temperature there because most of the kids are wearing shorts and t-shirts. One guy has on a jacket. One person has no shirt on at all. Down the street on either side are buildings, all painted white. Some have dark roofs. One has a bright red roof. One has a steeple on it. So it might be a school or a church. There are mostly low buildings, mostly one story, but there's a railroad track there. Don't know whether it's in service or not, and a red fire hydrant, and in the background, lots of trees and a couple of picket fences and some automobiles. So there's some commerce or something going on in the town behind the kids riding bikes in a circle. Again, the author of that was Bobby, B-O-B-I, Conn, C-O-N-N. Here's the risk report by Ian Bremmer. Japan's ruling party burns through another leader. It is not easy being Japan's prime minister. Though the center-right Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, has dominated the country's politics for nearly 7 decades, the top job has frequently changed hands. Fumio Kishida is just the third leader in the past quarter century to last at least 2 years, yet once again, change is coming. His weakness is obvious. A May poll from Japan's NHK put Kishida's approval rating at a dismal 24%, down from 36% in October 2023. To remain prime minister, Kishida must stay on as president of the ruling LDP. His current term in that role ended in September, and an especially rough night for his party in special elections in April makes it unlikely he can hold on. How did Kishida get there? Rising consumer prices, a weak Japanese yen, accusations of economic mismanagement dogged Kishida. Nor is he helped by reports that Japan will slip to the world's fifth largest economy by 2025, just behind India. Months earlier, Japan fell into fourth place behind Germany. But Kishida is also a victim of the LDP's political malpractice. Under his leadership, the party has faced a major campaign fundraising scandal and a resulting criminal investigation. 4 senior LDP officials have been pushed out of the party and dozens more disciplined, but critics charge Kishida has accepted no personal responsibility for the wrongdoing, despite news that some of those implicated were his close political allies. Kishida's best chance of keeping his job is indecision within the party over who could replace him. No one commands widespread support, and all the best-known contenders have weaknesses. Some leading LDP members are popular with the public, but do not have key allies within the party itself. Kishida did his best to remain afloat through the summer, but it appears, like many Japanese prime ministers before him, Kishida will spend his final months on the job as a political dead man walking. And that item was slightly abridged. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott. Washington correspondent, former President Donald Trump bullied the Republican National Committee into passing a 2022 resolution declaring zero cooperation with the nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. Trump was convinced the group that has run the event since 1988 was stacked against him. He also wanted the debates to start sooner and perhaps to number as many as 20. Double-digit double dates remain a long shot, but otherwise the ex-president is getting much of what he wanted. May 15, President Joe Biden and his campaign bypassed tradition to issue their own terms for a pair of one-on-one debates, and most of them matched up nicely with Trump's demands. Advisors to both camps, however, were all too aware that neither man had actively debated since their final meeting of the 2020 campaign. That's a long, or was a long, 1,374-day stretch between such tasks, only made more pronounced because both men bypassed primary debates. They may come to regret letting that skill set atrophy. Health Matters by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. Tick season is once again upon us. Well, that was last summer when this was written. And fears of Lyme disease. Most people who contract Lyme, that's L-Y-M-E, after a tick bite, fully recover after a course of antibiotics. But for roughly 10% of people, for reasons doctors do not fully understand, the medicine doesn't take, leaving them with chronic symptoms including fatigue, brain fog, and neurological issues that can be completely debilitating. Other people with Lyme are never treated at all, which can cause lasting issues without clear knowledge of where they originated. So-called chronic Lyme disease has for decades been one of the most controversial conditions in medicine. With some doctors dismissing the idea, people can experience long-term symptoms after a tick bite, and others suggesting these health issues are psychological or caused by something else entirely. No reliable diagnostic tests for chronic Lyme exist, and scientists have not reached a solid understanding of why these symptoms develop and persist. That uncertainty breeds doubt and scorn among some medical professionals. Sue Gray, 59, has lived with Lyme symptoms, including chronic pain, neurological problems, and mental health issues for nearly 30 years. She drained her bank account on visits to medical specialists, begging them to take her suffering seriously. Usually they don't. Nobody understands how horrific it is, she says. Nobody believes me. The situation is changing, though, and that's thanks in part to long COVID, another condition characterized by chronic symptoms following what should be an acute illness. After long COVID became a legitimate, widely studied condition in 2020, some researchers and physicians took a second look at chronic Lyme. Aided by millions of dollars in research funding from federal agencies and private donors alike. Teams across the U.S. are now working on developing better diagnostics and treatments for both acute and chronic Lyme, and trying to understand what goes on in the bodies of people who have these long-lasting symptoms. It will take considerable time for these studies to yield diagnostics and treatments, but attention from the scientific community is at least providing some much-needed hope to a patient community that has long lived without it. Time off, out of the mouths of babes. By Eliana Docterman. It's a new comedy, takes on the unfiltered realities of pregnancy, motherhood, and friendship. This may be a bridge. It appears to be a question and answer format. What if the millennials of Broad City had kids? In Babes, that show's co-creator, Ilana or Ilana Glazer, stars as Eden, a woman who gets pregnant and leans on her lifelong bestie, Dawn, Michelle Buteau, who has two kids of her own as she prepares for motherhood. Together they endure gigantic amniocentesis needles, unexpected leakages, and pregnancy-related horniness. Glazer, that's G-L-A-Z-E-R, co-wrote the movie and enlisted Pam Adlon, A-D-L-O-N, who tackled the complexities of single parenthood in her critically acclaimed dramedy, Better Things, to direct. Glazer Buteau, that's B-U-T-E-A-U, and Adlon spoke with Time about bringing motherhood in all its joyful messiness to the big screen, where it opened in June. Question, you all have children of different ages. What was it like revisiting that newborn stage in the movie, Buteau? Having boy-girl twins, I remember being so tired changing a diaper in the middle of the night and I started to cry because I was like, baby girl, you have a penis now. And my husband was like, that's the boy. You forget so much of that. Thank God Pamela was able to draw out the blackout moments. Adlon, I would write down all the cute things, the first kid would say, and by the third kid, she was like, what about all the cute things I say? And I don't even know. I left that kid twice, once at a birthday party and once in a car when I parked at a valet. That's what happens when you get to your third kid. I am skipping through this. Dawn and Eden struggle with how their relationship changes when Dawn has a second baby. This is very real for a lot of new moms. You cannot be spontaneous anymore. There is a gulf that opens up between people with kids and people without kids. That wasn't really a question, but here are the comments. Glazer, you really cannot know before you have a kid. It's been 3 years now that I've been a parent, and I'm just finding my footing again being a social member of my community. Watching Eden and Dawn talk it out, that's the healthiest version of the conversation we could conjure. In real life, there's a lot I wish I could say to my best friends, but I can't. Adlon, it is inevitable that you lose people in your life because you are sitting there at dinner with your childless friends and your children are screaming and your friends want to finish their story and you have to do 70 other things. You're like, let's take a rain check on this particular friendship. With Eden and Dawn, Dawn got the dream. She has the supportive dream husband, the dream house, the dream kids, and she feels like she got slammed into a brick wall. How do you deal with that when you theoretically have every blessing, but you feel like you're walking through molasses? The idea that you could actually have a conversation with your friend and find a way through it, that is what I hope for your generation. It is sometimes easier to be honest with a partner than a friend, another statement. Buteau, I've been married for 15 years. I am constantly working on communication with my husband through therapy and patience. But to have a hard conversation with my friend, the confrontation, will we still be friends afterwards? It spins me out just thinking about it. Glazer, it is true. With your partner, you are locked in. Especially once you have kids. You take that leap of faith constantly. There is more trust that you will stay together because there is an infrastructure to stay together. That does not happen with friends. These two friends draw boundaries, and that takes effort. But the relationship is stronger and healthier for it. And this is the final entry that I will read. Roe v. Wade was overturned when you were about to start shooting. In the movie, Eden gets pregnant unexpectedly and makes the choice to keep the baby. Did the new restrictions to abortion access change the way you dealt with that choice? Adlon, when we were shooting the scene where Eden and Dawn discussed the pregnancy, we used words that were so simple, like the way you would talk in kindergarten. It is your choice. Whatever you choose, I will be there for you. We have to simplify it to that extent because people have become so manipulated. Glazer, beyond the horrors of forced labor, forced birth, and forced parenting, besides the sadism that goes into these politicians working to make laws to abuse women and children, the thing that still felt the most important was to see women talking the way they talk to each other about this choice. I think that can lead us back to policy that protects women. That was abridged, and now it is time for Time Off Books. Feature, the decades-long build to Eruption by Annabelle Guterman. Again, this is under the caption Time Off Books. When Michael Crichton and his wife Sherry first started dating, all they did was hike. Every weekend there they were, taking in the scenery from the coasts of California to the mountains of Hawaii. The island of Kauai was their favorite place, its rivers carving through volcanic rock and steep, jagged cliffs cutting the sky. The couple would wake before dawn to be the first ones out on the trails, and together they would take in the sunrise. Those miles were sacred, and one of the few times Sherry could get a window into Michael's writing process. It was the early 2000s, and Michael was already a literary phenomenon and bona fide screenwriting machine, with novels and movie adaptations that made millions and spun franchises that continue today, chief among them Westworld, Twister, and Jurassic Park. At any given moment, he could be in the throes of research on multiple projects. But on those hikes with Sherry, he kept circling in on just one. It was early in our relationship when he said he had this book that was set in Hawaii and based on a volcano, she remembers. He would scratch his head. He was constantly working on it in his mind. Now, decades after its inception, that novel arrived June 3rd. Set on the Big Island, Eruption is an epic thriller about an impending volcanic eruption and a government secret with potentially fatal implications. At the center of it all is John McGregor, or Mac, a 30-something geologist who must lead a team of researchers through increasingly dangerous territory, all while trying to save the lives of as many people as he can. It is classic Crichton, a cinematic story rooted in science and infused with plenty of heart, tackling big themes like love and loss, but its journey to publication was unlike anything the author could have ever anticipated. In 2008, only 3 years into their marriage, Michael died of cancer while Sherry was pregnant with their son. Though the book that would become Eruption was the furthest thing from her mind at the time, Sherry knew she would return to it one day. Eventually, she would enlist the help of another prolific author, James Patterson, to do so. But it would be more than a decade before she was ready to find him. After Michael's death, Sherry's first priority was their son, John Michael. There was not any urgency to do anything right away, she says. It was day by day. I had this brand new baby alone, which was never, ever part of our plan. But in the back of her mind, unanswered questions lingered. There was so much about the professional side of Michael that she had only just begun to unlock. She wanted to know more so she could paint a complete picture of Michael to their son. To do so required the hefty emotional undertaking of sifting through the voluminous archive of work he left behind. In 2010, Sherry found the first pages of Eruption, and her world stopped. She felt it captured Michael's essence perfectly, his passion for nature, his dogged commitment to research, all with an undeniable narrative hook. There had to be more of this book somewhere. Though he was meticulous in his research, Michael filed his work away in multiple offices on different devices. Sherry dug through paper boxes and converted old floppy disks. Through her hunch, she realized he had been researching the book long before they had met, tracking different volcanoes on trips around the world. She uncovered one of his many work charts from 1994 that set up the novel, then set out to extract information from anywhere she could find it, looking out for any mentions of volcanoes. In the meantime, Sherry, who would become CEO of the company Crichton Sun, that's one word, published 4 of Michael's books posthumously, some with the help of other writers, including Richard Preston, author of The Hot Zone. But she held on to that book about Hawaii, the one that meant so much to them both, unwilling to do anything with it until she was sure she had all the pieces of this gigantic puzzle. She was certain he had written an ending, but all her searching never led to one. It was the ultimate cliffhanger, the one Michael did not want, obviously, she says. I really do feel everything in him wanted to finish this book, but we just lost him too soon. For 11 years, she held the book close to her chest. She says she wanted to preserve his legacy and protect his enormous footprint on pop culture, which just kept growing, even after his death. More than 15 years later, his work lives on. In July, Twister, a sequel to Twisters, that's plural, a sequel to Twister, singular, starring Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar Jones, hit theaters. There's also a new installment in his Jurassic World franchise, slated for release next year. Then there's his beloved medical drama, ER, which brought in over $3.2 billion for Warner Brothers after its 1994 debut. All of his ideas are like his children, Sherry says. He took care of them. He was specific about how he would nurture them, going back to edit, re-edit, reorganize, fill in new, updated research. This meant she could proceed with the eruption only when she knew that she had mined every inch of his archive. The next question was who could possibly finish the book. It had to be a writer who would compliment Michael, someone with storytelling skills who could weave this gripping narrative together. In 2021, she approached her agent with the only person she had in mind. What about putting two of the greatest storytellers of our time together? What about James Patterson? A collaboration machine, Patterson, whose books have sold more than 425 million copies, has worked with the former U.S. president and the Queen of Country. But unlike his books with Bill Clinton and Dolly Parton, Eruption would be the first he would complete for another writer, posthumously. The author, who had read all of Crichton's books, devoured the available pages, which included the book's protagonist, Mac, and the twin crises driving the plot. He eagerly signed on. The notion of one more Agatha Christie, one more John le Carré, one more Hitchcock, he recounts, we get one more Crichton. Isn't that cool? Though he was excited about infusing the book with his page-turning style, Patterson was also apprehensive. He's published books in almost every genre, from political thrillers to romance novels, but he was not used to dealing with so much science. So he hired a researcher from the University of Alaska Anchorage to help him with the material. Sometimes I don't dig deep enough, he admits. I dug deeper on this because that's the nature of something that Michael Crichton's name would be on. Together, he and Sherry completed Eruption in less than a year, with a constant channel of communication as Patterson shared his pages with Sherry for feedback. The result is a fast-paced, deeply considered story, one that Patterson and Sherry believe is so seamless, readers won't be able to tell where Crichton ends and Patterson begins. They hope to reach a wide audience, which shouldn't be hard to do, given the power of their fan bases combined, not to mention a hot Hollywood bidding war over movie rights. Every year, Sherry takes John Michael to Hawaii so they can spend time in the place his father cherished. If going there brings a certain peace to them both, so too does her decision to finish the work he never got the chance to. I do not have any hesitation of thinking whether I did the right thing, she says, knowing that the story he so wanted to tell will finally exist beyond the confines of those boxes. It feels like freedom. There's one small photo here. It's in color, but it's mostly black and white. It is the couple, the Crichtons, Michael and Sherry. In August of 2007, off the Amalfi Coast, each of them is dressed in black and white shorts and a black top. They're standing on some kind of watercraft because they're leaning against a guardrail right next to the ocean or the sea, and behind them are cliffs, gray cliffs with dark greenery on them and white buildings, and they're both smiling. Well, here's a preview of the most anticipated summer TV shows from last summer. I'll give you just a few that I might actually recognize. The preview is by Lucy Ford. Here's one, docuseries, Renfair, June 2 on HBO. A new series from Lance Oppenheim, Sperm World, immerses viewers in the Texas Renaissance Fair, the largest of its kind in the U.S., as its eccentric 85-year-old founder, King George, looks to step down and name his successor. America's Sweethearts, to be determined on Netflix. Perhaps no squad in sideline history is better known than the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. A new series from the creator of the wildly popular Cheer will take viewers behind the pom-poms. Presumed Innocent, June 12 on Apple TV+. Jake Gyllenhaal continues the trend of stars decamping to prestige TV as he finally crosses over for an adaptation of the 1990 Harrison Ford legal thriller itself, based on the 1987 novel by Scott Turow. And The Decameron, to be determined in July on Netflix, the comedic take on the bubonic plague, inspired by Giovanni Boccaccio's 14th century classic, assembles a crew of faves, including Veeps, Tony Hale, and girls, Zosia Mamet, as nobles and servants descending into societal collapse. Here's seven questions. This is about Michael Crow, president of Arizona State, on handling campus protests, embracing AI, the future of college sports, and partying. Sean Gregory writes this in the question-answer format. Let me see if there are seven. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. First, the question of Michael Crow. Are you in favor of colleges paying athletes? Answer, I am for very significant scholarships with significant stipends to help them be successful in the totality of their lives. But the second we start paying them, they are no longer a student athlete. They are an employee athlete. That is different. Question, since October 7, protests and conflicts over free speech have erupted on college campuses and beyond, it seems the job of university president has become one of the most stressful occupations in America. What is your stress level right now? Answer, the stress levels have gone up because we have to take leadership positions. We have to make decisions in a very difficult and challenging moment. Call hate speech, hate speech, and at the same time protect the right to free speech. The stress is how do we do that and not get sucked into the political whirlpools that are bent on some kind of negative outcome. Next, the pro-Palestinian protests and occupation of a building at Columbia University generated worldwide attention. What grade would you give Columbia's president, Manoush Shafiq, on her handling of the crisis? Answer, I'm not going to give grades to other university presidents. What I can say is it is important that universities be bastions for free speech, but it is important in being a bastion for free speech that we not be a bastion for anarchy. Question, at Arizona State, 72 arrests were made April 26 and 27 during a pro-Palestinian protest on campus. Why? Answer, we asked the police to come in and help us to take down an encampment, which we did, with no injuries and no use of weapons. We protected free speech. We did not permit hate speech or genocidal speech. We have to continue operating a university. We graduated 20,000 people, our largest spring graduation effort. We had over 250,000 visitors. We held over 30 convocation events. They all went on, and people were able to demonstrate, but nothing was interrupted. Question: what did you learn from this experience? Answer: you can maintain these values all at the same time. You have to be able to maintain safety. We did that. You have to be able to maintain the rights of the students to advance with their programs. We did that. You have to maintain free speech so they can freely express their views about the war, which they did, which is also fine. We had people showing up who were not pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli. They were pro-trouble. So we made sure that the pro-trouble people could not do what they were there to do. Question: you're the first higher education institution to have a collaboration with OpenAI. What benefits are accruing to students, faculty, and everybody else at Arizona State because of this relationship? Answer: do not think of AI as the Terminator bots that are going to come in and kill everyone. Think of it as this unbelievably intelligent tutor. We see it as probably the most important tool since the book that can enhance learning outcomes. Right now, we're building 1,000 AI tools. We are not viewing it as an existential threat to our species quite yet. We sort of view it like a computer that can answer our questions. And finally, question: when you took over ASU in 2002, the university had a strong reputation as a party school. Can you still go to ASU and have a good time? Answer: we were the world's most famous party school. There must be no drinking at Princeton and Dartmouth, I am sure of that. Arizona State's a place where you can go and you can choose between 450 undergraduate majors. It is a very serious institution. You can have fun, but that's no longer a moniker that describes the institution. Now for Time 100's Most Influential Companies 2024. Well, I'm going to look for something here that starts with, how about BlackRock? In the spotlight, BlackRock. It is not often people outside the business world pay attention to a CEO's letter to shareholders, but BlackRock's CEO, Larry Fink's 2020 letter saying the world's largest asset manager would put sustainability at the center of its investment approach and pushing other business leaders to do the same was still making ripples in the Republican presidential candidate debate in December 2023. BlackRock's position made it a culture war target among GOP candidates, and the backlash cost it business among state pension plans in some Republican-led states. While Fink has since eased off on environmental and social issues, he has the ear of the government officials around the world. With its $10.5 trillion in assets under management, BlackRock has a big enough stake in many influential companies to push them to change decisions and priorities. Its January deal to buy Global Infrastructure Partners for $12.5 billion is set to make it the world's second largest infrastructure firm, too. Alana Samuels wrote that brief column. And the next brief column was written by Joe Mullick. Tapestry, America's fashion conglomerate. High fashion has long been dominated by European conglomerates, LVMH, Kering, Richemont. With a major acquisition in August 2023, Tapestry is set to be the U.S.'s first real contender, home to Coach, Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman. It bought Capri Holdings, bringing in powerhouse brands Versace, Jimmy Choo, Michael Kors. The Federal Trade Commission is challenging the move, saying it would make the firm too dominant and entrench its foothold. European regulators have not shared the FTC's concern, but perhaps competitors should, since Tapestry likely is not done adding to its portfolio. The company's also been adroit in adapting to consumer trends and developing a strong e-commerce strategy, using generative AI to fine-tune its online personalization. CEO Joanne Crevoiserat said disciplined execution and the power of brand building helped drive record profits in the fiscal quarter ending December 2023. Turning the page, let's see what we have here. Toyota, evolving at its own speed. Again, these are the 100 most influential companies according to Time. Toyota Motor Corporation was well ahead of its time when it unveiled its game-changing Prius hybrid in 1997. But in recent years, the world's top-selling automaker caught flak for falling behind the industry's shift to full-on electrification. Now, with a new leader in the driver's seat, Toyota claims to catch up and pull ahead. Koji Sato began his tenure as the company's president in April 2023, promising an aggressive shift into electric vehicles, including 10 new EV models by 2026, up from just two. We have to change the future of cars to ensure they remain a necessity for society, Sato said. The Japanese behemoth is still partial to its original design. Its multi-pronged carbon neutrality strategy focuses as much on hybrid vehicles, including plug-in options, as on EVs. And as EV sales slowed in the U.S. last year, Toyota set a new global sales record, proving that in a time of transition, a diverse vehicle portfolio remains a winning strategy. That column was written by Jared Linzon. Apex Connecting Farmers by Katarina Hoya. To many of Nigeria's over 38 million smallholder farmers, poor access to markets, limited financing, and a lack of warehouses are a daily struggle. The arrival 10 years ago of AFEX, A-F-E-X, Commodities Exchange, Nigeria's first licensed private commodities exchange, instantly improved access to loans for buying seeds, pesticides, fertilizers, warehouse storage. The Abuja-based exchange takes farmers out of isolation and subsistence and includes them in an integrated agricultural system, buying their produce at market prices. To date, AFEX has reached over 500,000 farmers in countries including Nigeria, Kenya, and Uganda, and facilitated over 1 million metric tons in trades, matching producers with buyers on its digital platform, ComX. AFEX is now one of Africa's fastest-growing startups, raising $26.5 million in funding last year, and President Kunle Adesuya says it is aiming for $75 million more. And that may be pronounced AFEX, but it's spelled A-F-E-X. T-Mobile U.S., written by Varsha Bansal, out of this world connectivity. There are still yawning gaps in cell network coverage across the U.S. More than 500,000 square miles of the country does not receive a cell signal, according to T-Mobile U.S., affecting employment and educational opportunities in rural areas. In January, Starlink satellites with direct-to-cell, DTC, capabilities transmitted text messages through T-Mobile's network for the first time. The successful test was part of a partnership inked in 2022 between T-Mobile and SpaceX, which owns Starlink, that aims to support connectivity with ordinary smartphones anywhere in the U.S., with a clear view of the sky. Now the race for near-universal, satellite-based connectivity is heating up. AT&T in May announced a deal with AST SpaceMobile to bring satellite connections to its customers. Starlink, which plans to launch DTC-enabled satellites worldwide, has also partnered with carriers in Canada, Australia, and Japan. T-Mobile customers will get satellite text messaging later this year, the company says, with voice and data service coming. Some Android 15 beta users reported texting via satellite in May. Ludo, L-U-D-O. Studio by Don Steinberg. Streaming phenomena. Australian production company Ludo's Bluey, B-L-U-E-Y, was not just the most streamed children's show in the U.S. in 2023, but also the second most streamed show overall, per Nielsen. Airing in 60 countries, the hit helped push global distributor BBC Studios to top a record £2 billion, that would be $2.5 billion, in revenue in its 2023 annual report. Across its more than 150 7-minute episodes, starring 6-year-old dog Bluey and her tight-knit family, the cartoon rejects a kids versus adults ethos. It's been parents talking to other parents, saying this is a show you can watch with your kids, says Daly Pearson, director and co-founder of the Brisbane Space Studio. A Facebook group for grown-up fans has more than 500,000 members, and a podcast made by two obsessed moms has 1.6 million downloads. A 28-minute episode in April was a testing ground for longer-form shows or more. We would love to do a movie, Pearson says. Turning the page for perhaps one more short item. Frida, F-R-I-D-A, Transforming Parenthood by Eliana Docterman. Frida prepares parents for the unfiltered realities of child rearing. Its products have become baby registry staples, catering to parents and kids alike. One arm, Frida Mom, produces postpartum recovery essentials like instant ice pack pads, perineal bottles, and even kits for women who have experienced a miscarriage. Frida Baby offers parents tools like a battery-powered nail file as an alternative to using sharp nail clippers on tiny fingers, and the snot sucker to help parents dislodge baby boogers, a product so popular the company reports selling 3 million each year. In 2023, the company launched a new line, Frida Fertility, that offers everything from ovulation trackers to at-home insemination kits to help people on their journey to parenthood in the first place. Getting pregnant isn't always easy, says Frida CEO Chelsea Hirschhorn. After a year of trying, 1 in 6 couples struggles to conceive. Our hope is that we can lift the veil on the fertility journey in the same way we did for postpartum recovery and parenthood. Well, let's see if I can find another short one. Transcion, TRANSSION, by Joe Mullick. Again, smartphone success. This will probably be abridged. If you start naming the world's top smartphone makers, you'll probably stumble at number 5. Transcion is barely known in its home country of China, let alone in Europe or the U.S., but in emerging nations, Transcion's Infinix, Tecno, and Itel brands reign supreme. It is the biggest smartphone seller in Africa and is expanding in the Middle East and South Asia. In 2023, the company shipped 95 million phones, up almost 31% from 2022, according to the International Data Corporation, compared with Apple's 3.7% growth. Transcion has succeeded among the industry's global slump by threading a difficult needle: affordability, innovation, and trendiness. In 2023, its Infinix brand developed what it says is the world's first 260-watt fast charge technology, which can power a phone to 25% in just 60 seconds and 100% in a mere 7.5 minutes. Younger generations love the overall Transcion package, like a dedicated gaming chip in a smartphone at an attractive price point. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am reading from the North Carolina. I am Patricia, and I am reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That is G. Suggs Insurance, GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.